Garbage's Chris McGinnis.
Quiet, please. Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're
in exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. So, I've got a critical question for you. Should we build a brand new bridge across the Columbia River on Interstate 5 that includes, and this is no exaggeration, the single most expensive piece of light rail line on planet Earth? It will cost around $1 billion a mile, which is absolute insanity as far as I'm concerned. And if you compare it even to the hyper expensive Seattle light rail lines, they've been coming in lately at about $350 million a mile, which is already insanely expensive. Can you imagine a light rail line, not even 2 miles long, which is going to cost more than $1 billion per mile? I'll get into the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Monday, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. 26 stations around the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and we serve the region with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Glad to get your calls, too. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And our X poll today. Now, this one is really simple as far as I'm concerned. Should state worker contract negotiations, so this would be when the states of Oregon and Washington decide to negotiate a new contract on how much they're going to pay their workers, total compensation, fringe benefits, pension, gold-plated medical plan, and all of that. Should the public know what's in that contract before the contract is a done deal? And should state worker contract negotiations be known to the workers but secret from the taxpayers? My answer to that, big flat no. This should be the public's business. It is the public's money. These are public employees. I understand that they feel probably not too good about the fact that the public can find out how much they're getting paid when they do their job. And if you don't like that, go to work in the private sector. I've worked in the private sector my entire life. I've never had a government job, which means I don't have to worry about whether or not my salary is public or not because I work for the private sector. If you work in the government sector, should you have a right to have that kind of secrecy? My answer to that would be no. But Liz New of the Washington Policy Center points out Washington state employees plan to walk off the job at noon tomorrow to protest the governor's wage offer. And they have called that wage offer disrespectful. And they have said it is not providing livable pay rates to state employees. And if you wonder, if your first question as a taxpayer and a non-government employee is, well, if that paycheck is not a livable wage, and if it is disrespectful for Jay Inslee to suggest such a level of pay, how much are they getting paid? Fact is, you have no right to know. Now, 20 years ago, you would have known, because in 2004, they changed the rules, as she points out. State negotiations with union executives about how much taxpayers are going to compensate government employees have been secret for the last 20 years, since 2004, even though the talks with the governor's office involve hundreds of millions of dollars in spending per biennium. Before 2004, compensation decisions were made transparently with public hearings. They were part of the normal legislative budget process. They were made by your representatives. But now you're not allowed to know. And in fact, in some cases, the unions even tell their workers, you're not allowed to know how much we're negotiating for you. So the unions that represent the workers tell their own workers, pay your dues, shut up, We'll tell you how much you're getting paid after we're done with the deal. But it's worse for taxpayers because taxpayers are actually paying that bill and they're being told you have no right to know how much the negotiations are. So when the union workers say to the public, we want to get your attention, we're going to walk off the job tomorrow, Tuesday, because the governor's wage offer is disrespectful and does not provide a livable pay rate, but you have absolutely no idea how much they're being offered. Apparently the state employees do, but you don't. And do you have the right to do it, to know that? Should state worker contract negotiations be secret from the taxpayers? My answer to that is no. You can answer the X poll any way you like. You can find it at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Now, on First Amendment Friday, I ask you this. Should parents who place guns in the hands of juvenile killers face charges as well? Of course, this had to do with the Georgia shooting at Appalachie High School, in which Cold Gray, a 14-year-old, is now charged with four counts of murder, and he may go to prison for the rest of his life if convicted. His father has also been charged with two counts of manslaughter and multiple other counts connected to that case. So, should a parent who places guns in the hands of a juvenile killer face charges as well? I answer that one yes. 87% of you agreed. Only 13% of you said no. But let me get back to planet Earth's single most expensive light rail line that is currently estimated will cost $1 billion per mile. It is 1.9 miles long, so it's going to cost $2 billion to build less than 2 miles of light rail line. And let me point out some problems. Every time I see a conventional news story on this in the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, whether it's the Seattle Times or OregonLive.com, whether it's on television or anywhere else, the reporters usually leave out what I consider some key elements of that story. Number one, the Coast Guard approval of this bridge is necessary. They cannot build it without Coast Guard approval, which they do not have. And so far, the Coast Guard has said you are building the bridge 60 feet too short to clear the traffic on the Columbia River, and they have not given their approval. The three governments, Oregon, Washington, and the federal government, do not have the money set aside to be able to build this bridge. And that's a problem. Tolling to pay for the project, that is opposed in both the state of Oregon and the state of Washington. And then, of course, there's the light rail problem. But before we even get to that, consider this. Transit advocate and critic John Lee points out, right now, Clark County, Clark C-Tran, which is the public transit agency in Clark County, they have seven express bus lines that run across that bridge. And you say, well, they must be carrying thousands of people. They do not. The average number of people that they carry per day on those seven bus lines that are running all day long is 525 people. Now, if there is demand for a light rail line, where do you see that demand? And the comparison to Seattle, the brand newly opened Linwood Light Rail Extension costs Seattle, or Puget Sound, about $353 million a mile. Is there anything in the world that justifies spending three times as much to build a light rail line across the Columbia River on a bridge that hasn't been funded yet, does not have Coast Guard approval, and the tolling to pay for it is opposed by the public on both sides of the river? Just something for you to consider the next time you see one of those great stories about the federal government is putting $500 million into the bridge. The bridge does not exist, and I don't think it ever will at this rate. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The 40th President of the United States always knew where to put the blame.
You have blamed mistakes of the past, and you blame the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, your body well right. You know you got a right to say.
This
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Oh, poor, poor Marie Perez. You know, the freshman member of Congress from Washington's 3rd Congressional District, she's in the fight of her political life right now, and she has some tough choices to make. Perez broke with her Democrat Party friends to support a new law against non-citizens voting. Now, that is the right call, of course. Perez didn't do it for the right reasons. She did it for political reasons. She voted to stop illegal aliens from voting in elections because right now she's in a very tight race with Joe Kent. Now, 2 years ago, Perez only eked out a victory of less than 1% of all the votes. It was actually 0.85% of all the votes cast. She only won by about 2,600 votes. Kent is a rock-solid conservative. Perez is a screaming left-wing liberal. In fact, Joe Kent got endorsed by Donald Trump and is endorsed this time by President Donald Trump. Perez wants to look like she's something she's absolutely not, which is a political moderate. And that's why she cast the vote she did. Now the citizen voting law has been attached to a government funding bill. The Democrat Party wants to kill the voting law because it gets in the way of the DNC using illegal aliens in the upcoming election. Voting no on the funding and voting bill saves the Democrats, but it might just end Congresswoman Perez's career. Voters in the 3rd Congressional District chose Donald Trump. Trump endorsed Joe Kent. And now Perez must choose. Does she vote to save her own seat in Congress, or does she vote to please her political party and let voters know who she really is? And today's question of the day from Dagny Taggart. Hey, Lars, why do all those who preach tolerance the most end up being the least tolerant of anyone who disagrees? She writes, I was unfriended by 4 people on Facebook this last weekend. 4 of my liberal friends who preach about DEI and tolerance and acceptance could not accept a difference of political opinion. But it's like you always say, Lars, if it weren't for double standards, the left would have no standards at all. Thanks for all you do. Signed, Dagny Taggart. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Well, in context for this next one, Oregon has played guinea pig for the country before. The last time, it was ballot measure 110 that legalized hard drugs. And what was the result of that? Thousands of Oregonians literally died of drug overdoses, and more thousands and thousands of people suffered from overdoses. So it was a bad idea. It was sponsored by people from out of state. It was sponsored by people on the East Coast who don't have to give a damn how it works out on the ground. Well, once again, we have that same kind of situation. The Yes on Measure 118 campaign, which is the Oregon Rebate Political Action Committee. This is the idea that you raise a gigantic tax on corporations, and the tax applies whether the corporation is making money or losing money, and then they would cut a check for about $1,600 once a year to every single man, woman, and child in the state. It is a small version of socialism. That is ballot measure 118. Well, the Yes on 118 committee has now filed some of its contributions and expenditures reports. $100,000 comes from a character by the name of Dylan Hirschfeld, a former Tesla engineer who's currently running for mayor of San Francisco. As the candidacy suggests, he is not a resident of Oregon, and neither are the funders who paid for the signature gathering that actually placed Measure 118 on the ballot. So you have one more experiment. Let's try this experiment in Oregon, and the people funding it don't have to deal with the consequences. I just ask you to be aware of that. The people who put it on the ballot are not from Oregon. The biggest funder of this thing is not from Oregon. It is, in fact, a man running for mayor of San Francisco, which tells you a whole lot. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Philip Hodap writes in, Lars, Let me start by saying I don't have all the details because I work 100 hours a week and I don't have time to do the research to dig into it. But I heard on your flagship station that the Boeing union employees are getting raises up to 25% and management up to 40%. Now, as far as I'm concerned, workers deserve to be paid fairly for what they produce. But I'm pretty sure that in my job, if I produce these spectacular, costly, and highly publicized failure after failure that Boeing has, the only thing I'd be getting from my employer would be a pink slip. And Philip, I absolutely agree with you. Can you imagine this? Airplanes with parts that blow off in midair and put passengers at risk. A Starliner spaceship that gets to the space station and then has to come back empty because they think bringing the astronauts back on it might just have left them dead. It happened to land safely in New Mexico over the weekend, but that's not the point. The point is Boeing has produced disaster after disaster, and I think a lot of it traces back to the company's belief in diversity, equity, and inclusion. And after all of that, you're going to give workers 25% raises over the next 4 years and management up to 40% raises? Boy. Sounds like a government job to me. Let's go to Sandy. Hey, Sandy, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
You brought up the question about letting the public know what is in the negotiations of the employee's contract when they're negotiating, and should the public know, being taxpayers? I would agree with that due to the fact I am a union. I have been union, but I believe in fairness to the taxpayer, and I am a taxpayer. In 2012, we were negotiating a contract of the ATU. We went into negotiations. We went out and publicly notified people what was going on. But when it was all ended, because we only have two arbitrators in the Northwest, Arbitrator Gaba is who we went with. And yeah. Arbitrator Gaba, when he made his decision, he said, due to the fact that TriMet was illegal on all five accounts, and this is public knowledge, that he is going to vote in public opinion. I asked as a union officer at the time and as a union worker, who is public opinion? And he could never tell me that because that never went to a vote to the public. So I believe everybody, whether you're union or non-union, as long as you're a taxpayer, should have the right to know who is in those contracts. Because if arbitrators can make a decision on public opinion that never went to a vote, I consider that to be illegal.
That's nicely said, Sandy. And in fact, I was just talking a moment ago about Boeing. Boeing is a private company, and yet the worker numbers are public. They're going to get a 25% raise. Now, it may be that whatever the workers are seeking from Jay Inslee is a fair amount. It may not be, but we don't know. And if they don't want to tell the public, my question would be, if the public is paying the bill, shouldn't the public have a right to know what kind of raises you're handing out to public employees? If you don't want your raises to be publicized, go to work for a private company. But I'm with you. If the public knows, and the workers know that the public knows, you're going to probably get a more fair result. At the very least, if the public is writing the check, they're paying the taxes, they have to know what's going on. Glad to be with you on a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Nixon was wrong about a lot of things, but he's right about this.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
What say you, Joe Biden? This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Here's a question to consider. Did Democrat-dominated King County use illegal ballot curing, and we'll explain what ballot curing is, to score an improbable win for a Democrat? Jim Walsh believes that they did, and I believe that they did as well. Jim is the chair of the Washington State Republican Party. Welcome back, sir.
Good to talk to you, Lars. And yeah, this is a issue really worth some attention. That ballot curing we talk about, that's the thing where if on a ballot the signatures don't match or there's some other technical problem, voters are given a small window around election time to fix that problem. Usually it's that signatures don't match. And there's an affidavit, a standard affidavit form the state produces that allows a person to say, yeah, that is in fact me, and then their vote gets counted. The controversial part here is King County didn't use the standard form that the state produces for correcting a mismatch. They used an online phone app to make an affidavit saying, yeah, that's me, for voters where there was a problem. And the law is pretty clear in Washington that when a voter is fixing that kind of problem on a ballot, the voter has to communicate directly with the county election official. And this phone app is an intermediary. They're a middleman. And we think that is not the proper policy to follow, procedure to follow under the law. And so we're challenging some of those cured ballots in the recent primary up in King County.
Well, not just some, but you're challenging more than 2,000 of them. And if it turns out that they did it in a way that violates state law, is that enough votes to change the result?
We believe it is. And we are asking the court to consider that and give us a quick answer, we hope, on the matter. But even if we can't get the quick answer, we want the court to make a going forward order that King County can't use this phone app for curing ballots, that they would have to use the standard form, which is paper and ink with a wet signature on it, that the state produces.
I mean, just so people understand, and Jim, tell me if I state this wrong. I vote in Clark County. If I vote and I get a phone call or some message that says, Lars, you sent in your ballot and you dummy, you forgot to sign it, I need to, in most cases, go down to the county elections headquarters, which are a couple of miles away, and I need to walk in, identify myself, show picture ID, and then sign the ballot so my ballot goes from sick to cured. That's what a typical cure would be, right?
That's correct. And you can do it by mail in Washington. You have to have someone attest, a witness who says, yeah, you're you. But you can put it in the mail if you do it timely and send it to the county. But the communication has to be directly between you and the county. The problem with the phone app is the phone app company is a middleman here, and that, we believe, violates the letter of election law in Washington.
Okay, now tell me this, Jim. You said you're pretty sure the law is pretty clear. Is there any wiggle room in that law at all that says the county, King County, can say, well, we found another way to do it, and it says, so any method for curing the ballot that the county elections headquarters says is okay, or is there no wiggle room in that?
We believe there's no wiggle room. Here's where the county is making kind of an argument back. King County right now uses this phone app to do local elections for its conservation district, local to King County. The complicating thing there, Lars, is conservation districts in Washington are described, their elections are controlled by a separate section of state law. The section of state law that applies to all other elections is RCW Chapter 29A. And curing ballots for a primary or a general election is covered by 29A, and the relevant subsection of 29A is the part that says that that connection between the voter and the county has to be direct. So the fact that they're using it for another kind of election, a local election that's covered under another section of law, really is not relevant to our point, which is that the relevant part of state law says the connection has to be direct and they can't use this phone app for that purpose.
Let me see if I can add to that just a little bit, because, Jim, one of my favorite parts of the U.S. Constitution, one of my favorite documents after the Bible, is that the Constitution says every state can set the laws for its elections. But it also says those laws will be set by the legislature, not by a judge, not by the court, not by the governor, not by the Secretary of State of the Elections Division or the county elections clerk. It has to be set by the folks in Olympia. And if it's not, then it's not in the law. And like you said, if you want to have a local district of some kind and invent your own rules, well, the Constitution doesn't speak to that, because all it says is four elections that are federal elections. So Congress, Senate, president, and vice president, that must be set by the legislature of the state. county could go ahead and invent whatever it wants for these little districts, but they're not allowed to do it for elections that are governed by the U.S. Constitution and only the legislature in Olympia. Do you think I've overstated that?
No, that's exactly right, and that's the point that we're trying to make in court over these cured ballots. And like I said, we'd like to see an immediate fix to the election that just happened, but we understand that time is fleeting on that. We definitely want a going forward order from the court that what King County was doing with this phone app is not legal for this purpose. It may be for others, like you say, but for these elections, they can't do it.
Well, but
that's the important part.
And I understand the conservative approach, say, at least give us the going forward. But here's my question. When does the state land? Well, the state lands office is going to be decided by a November runoff. And the question is whether it's this Democrat who appears to have falsely won based on the cured ballots, or is it Sue Keel who's going to win it, who won it because she got the greater number of votes. And I think you pointed out the likelihood of a recount or something like that of changing this was like one in a billion. So there's time, or how much time do they have to actually correct this and put her name on the ballot instead of the Democrat?
Not a lot of time, Lars. We're looking at a matter of days.
Okay.
But we're hoping, and that was the reason we filed when we did, as quickly as we did, we're hoping that the courts up here will give us a decision fairly quickly. We filed in Snohomish County about King County, which we're allowed to do under state law because we believe it's better to use an impartial judge who's not directly in the county where there's a dispute. So the case is being heard in Snohomish County about King County, and we're hoping to get an answer quickly in the next few days.
I want to ask you this. I know you're the Washington State GOP, Jim, but it sounds like Kamala Harris is running against herself. She just posted some policy positions finally today, and one of them says Vice President Harris and Governor Walz believe in tough, smart solutions to secure the border, keep communities safe. And I thought, hold on, you were in charge of this for 3.5 years, and now you're saying you are, in fact, in favor of a tough border, but you weren't for the last 3.5 years.
I actually feel for the woman, Lars. She's in an impossible situation. She is one of the most far-left legislators in D.C. And has been really kind of a no-show as vice president. And she's in an impossible situation. In order to have any chance of being elected, she has to basically spin and do a pivot on most of the public policy positions she's held. I kind of feel for her, Lars. It's not going to be a pleasant couple of months for Kamala Harris.
I think between now and tomorrow night, she's going to be spinning like a top. That is Jim Walz talking about the illegal method that King County used to sway a statewide election in the state of Washington. Back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. With everything.
Gun Control Explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls. That's what the Radio Northwest Network has always been about. More than 25 years we've served the Pacific Northwest and some of the crazy things that go on in this region. For example, in Washington State, there are Washington State employees who plan to walk off the job at noon tomorrow. They say they are protesting the governor's wage offer that they describe as disrespectful and not being a livable pay rate. And you might say, well, then what is the pay rate? No, you're not allowed to know. What do you mean I'm not allowed to know? I'm a taxpayer in Washington State. I pay that bill. Can you tell me how much the governor is offering them that is so outrageous that the workers would actually call it disrespectful and not a livable pay rate? Well, it turns out for the last 20 years that all negotiations between your representatives, the governor, the legislature, and the rest, and union executives by law are not public. They're not held in public hearings. You're not allowed to know. You only know when they finally work out the deal, and then they tell you this is how much your representatives have agreed to pay the workers who call themselves public servants. That is, they serve you, but you're not allowed to know how much of a raise they're being offered until the raise is already locked in stone with a signed contract. So, I framed the question this way. Should state worker contract negotiations be known to workers but secret from the taxpayers? I answer that one no. You can answer any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Friday's question on First Amendment Friday, should parents who place guns in the hands of juvenile killers face charges as well? I answered that one yes. 87% of you said yes. 13% of you were naysayers. And this has to do with Colt Gray, the 14-year-old who is now charged with four counts of murder in the state of Georgia, as well as other crimes as well. His father has also been charged with manslaughter because his father got a visit from the FBI just over a year ago in which the FBI said, we have heard that your son has been making threats to shoot up his middle school. He was 13 years old a year ago. And the son said, no, I didn't make those threats. And the father said, I don't know. And then about 7 months later, the dad decided to give the kid an AR-15 for Christmas. So, would you put a gun in the hands of a juvenile? And if that juvenile goes out and murders people, should the person who put the gun in the hands of the juvenile that did the murdering, allegedly, should that person face charges as well? I said yes. A number of you said no. It was an interesting result for an ex-poll. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. Now, in terms of crazy things that go on in government, I kind of think that the people who run the city of Portland probably should have used some of those infamous Kamala Harris Venn diagrams. If you remember Venn diagrams from school, even if it was decades ago, that's where you make a circle that has everybody in this circle, and then you see where the circles intersect so you know how many people you're talking about. Apparently the people who oversee Portlandia, the city of Portland, had made a real error. There is a committee that is supposed to oversee Multnomah County and Portland in terms of spending money on the so-called homeless crisis. Now, spending last year was more than $550 million. So if they need a citizen committee to oversee anything, they needed for that. But guess what happened? They made the requirements to be on the committee so tight that they have two spots that are completely unfilled. And that's where it gets even more comical. Here's why. They're supposed to have 10 people on the committee, and one of the members has to be a Multnomah County resident who pays what's called the Metro Supportive Housing Services Tax, which is a tax only on the high-income residents. But the person cannot live in the city of Portland. Now, if you've ever looked at a map of the city of Portland and a map of Multnomah County, there's not a lot of Multnomah County that's not inside the city of Portland. There are various other cities like Gresham and Troutdale and Wood Village and the like. But if you say, we want to find all the people in Multnomah County, now just take out all the people who live in the city of Portland, then take out all the people who don't make a big paycheck, a big enough one to have to pay the homeless services tax, housing services tax, and then we want to find somebody who doesn't live in the city of Portland but does live in Multnomah County and does make a big income and does pay the tax, oh, and that wants to serve on the committee. And one more thing about it. If you serve on the committee to oversee the spending of all this money, you are considered a non-voting member, which means you get to do all the homework and you don't get a chance to vote on whatever the committee recommends one way or another. Now, can you imagine they might be having a tough time finding somebody? The second position that's open is even more comical. The second position has to be a behavioral health practitioner, meaning a shrink of one kind or another, shrink or social worker, from an organization that does not have a contract with the city or the county. Apparently, that person effectively doesn't exist either, which tells you something. You've got all these people working for all these different psychological health organizations, and all of them are making money from the city or the county. It sounds like they've created their own problem, and I don't think they ever intended to have those people on the committee to begin with. It's Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday, and always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. This is the Radio Northwest Network. It's honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest. And we got a lot to talk about. Corruption down to the core in criminal justice in Portlandia. You've got strange decisions being made in King County as well. And in Idaho, they have decided that there will be a change of venue, meaning they are moving the trial of one of the most recent, most notorious mass murders in the Pacific Northwest. That's the Koberger case. And I thought we'd talk about all of that with my friend, former DA Josh Marquis, who joins me now. Josh, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Lars.
Let's start with that change of venue. So the judge has decided in the case of Brian Koberger, and people should remember that he is the man who now stands accused in court and may face the death penalty for having murdered, allegedly, four young college kids in Idaho. And so his lawyers, I think, have tried everything else. I think they know that the prosecution has him pretty well dead to rights. So they've come in and said, we can't get a fair trial in this town. How does change of venue work? And how far away are they going to have to move him to have not, say, the same public notoriety for their client that they do in that part of Idaho?
Well, as many people remember, there's nothing alleged about the murder. The three young women and young man were very definitely murdered. Koberger is a very interesting suspect. He was a graduate student in criminal justice, waiting to get his PhD at Washington State University. And he was arrested about 6 weeks after the four bodies were discovered on the campus of the University of Idaho in Moscow. And the case has gotten unbelievable amounts of publicity, even more than you would expect when four young people are murdered for no apparent reason. At least publicly, there's been no discussion of any relationship between the three girls and the young man and Koberger. In fact, if anything, the prosecution has leaked out information that he seems to be a kind of a Charles Manson / Ted Bundy wannabe. And when he was arrested in Indiana weeks later, because he'd been targeted by the FBI and by police. He was utterly cool, showed no indication that he was about to be arrested. And your listeners should know that, unlike Oregon, when the prosecutors in Idaho said they're seeking the death penalty, they mean it. Idaho is one of the few states that both has the death penalty on the books and actually uses it. And unlike Oregon, Idaho is a very red state. And although Ada County, which is where the case has been moved to, which is Boise, the state capital, is slightly less conservative than some of the other counties, including the county where the crime took place. We're talking about places where it would be, you know, I don't think there's any jury that would just exclude the death penalty. I mean, if the case were to be held in Oregon, where technically we still have the death penalty, trying to get a death penalty out of a jury in, let's say, Corvallis or Portland would be next to impossible, regardless of what people said. I think there's just such hostility and so many myths. But that's not the case in Idaho. So the main issue is can you get jurors, can both sides, but particularly can the defense get jurors that haven't completely made up their mind about both the guilt of Kohlberger and what is the appropriate penalty? Now, one argument, and the defense will use this, is that this case has gotten such notoriety, and there have been literally thousands of people who've moved into Moscow. The people in Moscow were not happy about it. They felt that they were really being oppressed by pop-up self-proclaimed reporters, podcasts, all kinds of stuff. So Ada County is Boise. It's a much bigger city, but there's a lot of opinions there too. And it's like any really well-known case, as having been both a defense attorney in capital cases and more frequently a prosecutor, when you have those people, you call up to the jury box and you say, okay, have you heard about this case? You'd be a little concerned if in this day and age, if they lived in Idaho, they said, nope, never heard of it at all. Your suspicion would be either they're lying to you or that they live in a basement.
Well, except for one thing, Josh, and you tell me if I'm wrong. It doesn't matter if you've heard about the case. You have to tell the court, yes, I've heard about it, but I haven't made up my mind, and I can listen to the evidence presented in court and make my decision as a member of the jury based on what I hear and not based on some preconceived notions that I have where, oh, no, he's guilty as hell, and I don't care what I hear in the trial. As long as you can persuade the court that you are somebody who will listen to the evidence and make a decision on that and only that, then you can seat a jury, right?
Absolutely. You don't. It would be unrealistic and even spooky if somebody said, oh, I've never heard of it. All you can ask for is, listen, you may have heard of this. Are you willing to consider this case and make the decision based solely on the evidence that is allowed in here in this courtroom? And if the judge tells you, let's say a bell is rung or a statement is made, but you may not consider that, will you be capable of excluding that? And then the biggest question in death penalty cases is what's called death qualification. So on the one hand, you have jurors that say, you know, I don't really like the death penalty, and I'm not sure if I could do it. Then the prosecution's going to ask the potential juror, well, okay, it's the law. Are you saying that no matter what, that you wouldn't be able to render a verdict of death, even if you thought it was appropriate because of your moral or religious beliefs? If the person says, I can't be, then they're what we call Witherspoon. It's the name of a case, Witherspoon, that says a person who has such deep moral opposition won't be on it. The flip side is, too, by the way, there are jurors, and I ran into this much more frequently in Bend, when I obtained three death verdicts against Grandy Guzik between 1990 and 2010, you'd have jurors say, yep, I've heard this case. And, yeah, if this evidence is true, there's only one verdict and only one verdict that I'd possibly consider, that'd be death. And that person is also not eligible because they've already made a decision that makes it unfair for them.
I want to ask you about one other thing in the last minute we've got. Last week, he had charges brought against Colt Gray in Georgia for murder in the shootings at his high school. He's 14. His father has also been charged with manslaughter. And I want to know what you think of the idea of saying if a parent puts guns in the hands of a juvenile who then ends up going out and murdering, that we can bring charges as well. What do you think about that?
I hope there's more than that. I mean, the mere fact that the parent bought the gun and allowed, say, the teenager to have it should not be enough. My understanding is it goes beyond that, that the parent may very well have been aware of some of the threats made by the teenager and may nonetheless have continued and have covered up. That's why you have lesser charges like manslaughter. And obviously, I don't think any parent would go forward knowing their kids would do it.
Except for the fact that he'd already had the visit from the FBI investigating alleged death threats by his son to shoot up the school. That's Josh Markey, the former DA. Glad to be with you on a Monday. We'll get to your phone calls and your emails and talk just a bit about Kamala Harris up next.
be singing what I'm singing, but I'm just saying what you're thinking.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
He plays from this really old and tired playbook, right? Where he, there's no floor for him in terms of how low he will go. And we should be prepared for that. We should be prepared for the fact that he is not burdened by telling the truth.
That is Kamala Harris, and just to give full credit, she did a radio show called The Ricky Smiley Show. She's not doing a lot of interviews. She's not answering a lot of questions. She's certainly not holding full-blown news conferences. You would think that she'd want to, because at this point, Kamala Harris just today has finally put up on her website a few pages of information about the policies that she supports, because an awful lot of Americans have been pointing out, well, in 2019 and 2020, she supported this. For example, she supported amnesty for illegal aliens. She supported decriminalizing the illegal entry into the United States. She was in favor of banning fracking. I mean, you can go right down a long list of things that Kamala Harris stood for that today we're at least led to suspect she no longer stands for, but you don't know because you can't ask her because she doesn't answer questions. But in this case, she's talking about what happens tomorrow night. The big debate, the only debate in the month of September that Kamala Harris was willing to agree to. Donald Trump had actually said, I've negotiated three debate dates, the 4th of September, the 10th of September, tomorrow, and then one later on this month. Kamala Harris has agreed only to this one, and she actually wanted to change the rules of the debate to unmute the microphones. Now, you see, the Democrats back when Joe Biden, before they kicked him to the curb, the Democrats had decided, I know, we're going to sabotage Trump. We're going to mute the microphones. That'll hamstring him when he's dealing with Joe. Well, it didn't do that at all. In fact, Joe fell flat on his face. So when Kamala Harris she actually challenged Trump, said, let's do a debate. And he said, fine, I've arranged three dates with three different networks. Let's do it. And then Kamala Harris immediately backed off. In fact, a lot of us are expecting to hear tonight or tomorrow morning that Kamala has COVID, or she has bunions, or she has something that's going to keep her from showing up on the debate stage. Who knows? Maybe she'll show up after all. I mean, today her campaign came out with a list of some of the policies, and I'll get into that in just a moment. But this is what's crazy. If Donald Trump just does this, if he shows up on the debate stage and he reminds Americans, I want to know what Kamala Harris's position is on the rioters of BLM and Antifa. Remember when Kamala Harris helped raise hundreds of thousands of dollars to bail out violent accused criminals who'd been arrested during those BLM riots? Do you remember when she said she wanted to dismantle ICE, that's Immigrations and Customs Enforcement? And why would she do that? Because she doesn't want to make it illegal to come into the United States illegally. She has supported reparations. She has supported defunding the police. She has supported violent accused criminals. Does she still stand for all those things? Nobody really has any idea. In fact, if you ask most people who say they're going to vote for Kamala Harris, why are you voting for Kamala Harris? Well, because she's not Donald Trump. And you say, well, what is it about her that makes her a great candidate to be president of the United States? Most of the Democrats can't tell you. In fact, most of my naysayer callers can't tell me why. So if you want to join the conversation, you're certainly welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. You can also vote in our X poll. You'll find a brand new question of the day every single day written out of the news of the day. And you'll find that at Lars Larson Show on X. You also find the same question on my website at LarsLarson.com. Now, this next soundbite is very short, but I want you to listen closely to what Kamala Harris has to say.
Look, it's time to turn the page on the divisiveness.
It's time to turn the page on the divisiveness. Now, let me tell you, I always allow that the Democrats need double standards, because if they didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all. Understand that Kamala Harris is the vice president currently to the interim president of the United States, and that would be Joe Biden. Now, has Joe Biden been divisive? Well, Joe Biden is the one who's come out, along with other members of the Democrat Party, and he said, these MAGA Republicans. Now, I would ordinarily expect him to bash on Donald Trump. He doesn't like Donald Trump. He wanted to beat Donald Trump. He thought he beat Donald Trump in 2020. He really didn't, but he thought he did. But why is he bashing the rest of America? Because understand, make America great again is the slogan of the vast majority of Republican voters in America. That is a giant chunk of America's population. And yet Joe Biden has had no problem bad-mouthing people who believe in making America great again. So when Kamala Harris, as his vice president, comes out and says, it's time to turn the page on the divisiveness, there, I don't think, has been another presidential regime as divisive as Joe Biden, unless you go back, say, to Barack Obama. But even Barack Obama, I don't think, was as openly divisive as Joe Biden has been. So what about those new policies? Because when Kamala Harris was anointed as the choice of the Democrat Party, without voters, without delegates getting any kind of choice, she was just announced by the Democrat Party leadership, this is your candidate, this is who you get. Everybody began asking, well, is she still in favor of decriminalizing illegal entry to the U.S.? Is she still in favor of banning fracking? Is she still in favor of nationalized health care? Is she still in favor of raising money to bail out violent criminals? Is she all of those things or none of those things? Where does she stand? So what did she do? She came out with a few dozen pages. It was almost three different pages of policy proposals. And what do they include? Restore and protect reproductive freedoms, meaning abortion, except that even the folks who advocate for abortion, like Kamala Harris, don't want to say the A word because somehow the A word is toxic to them. So they frame it up as restore and protect reproductive freedoms. Now, what freedom they're trying to restore, the Supreme Court decided there never was a right to abortion in the U.S. Constitution. So what freedom she's talking about restoring, I don't know. And reproductive freedoms, you can reproduce all you want. What the Dobbs decision meant was that every one of the 50 states, 58 if you're an Obama fan, could make their own decisions on abortion. Abortion is not reproduction. Abortion is the opposite of reproduction. And then National Review had pointed out there were no issues or policy section at all on the Harris Walls campaign website. I pointed out the same thing myself. And if you want to compare this, this is what NR did, comparing Kamala Harris to Barack Obama, comparing Kamala Harris to Hillary Clinton. Barack Obama, by late August of 2008, and he was just campaigning for the first time. She's had plenty of practice already. He had released a 3-dozen-page blueprint for change, including policy proposals on 23 different subjects, including the economy, education, healthcare, and homeland security. Now, I don't particularly like Obama or his policies, but at least you knew what he stood for. 2016, Hillary Clinton's campaign had 40 policy blurbs that explained her positions on the issues. Now, what does Harris's rollout today do? It has a paragraph about Donald Trump's Project 2025. Well, first of all, it's not his Project 2025. It came from the Heritage Foundation, and he's disavowed this thing. So Kamala Harris is going to walk into that debate on Tuesday night. We don't really have any idea of where she stands at all. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
He may talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you and a real pleasure to welcome to the program RNC National Spokeswoman Elizabeth Pipko. Elizabeth, you should know ahead of time that we try to be ecumenical around here. So we've invited your Democrat colleague, your Democrat counterpart, to come on the show. And so far in several years or several decades of asking, we don't have any Democrats willing to come on and speak up for Comrade Kamala. But I want you to talk about what all of us should expect to see tomorrow night on that debate stage.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for having me. Not surprised that no one wants to show up and defend Kamala Harris. look, I think when it comes to what we're expecting tomorrow, it's a clean debate. It's a fair debate, right? The American people deserve better. But to have any kind of games played, because this is an election that's, you know, very, very pivotal for a lot of us. I've heard it described as life or death. I know that we say every 4 years how important these elections are, but this one truly, truly feels like it could change the scope of our country and the world as well. So I think for us, it's about hoping that Donald Trump is treated fairly and just being excited for both candidates to finally get that moment to be directly compared. We've seen Donald Trump do interview after interview, press conference after press conference, while Kamala Harris has kind of been hidden or has hidden herself away for whatever reason. So I think it's time for the American people to see the two candidates going head to head on the policies and the issues and the future plans that they both have for this country, because that's what matters, right? And that's what we should all be looking for.
What'd you make of the fact that her campaign finally at long last put some of her alleged policies on the website today, but they don't seem to be very specific at all? In fact, they seem to be a whole collection of generalities.
I was going to say they don't look like actual policy proposals as much as, you know, a few sentences for a summary on each one on what, you know, she hopes will appease both sides as well as she possibly can. That's not a policy proposal, and it also doesn't answer the question of why she has flip-flopped as much as she has over the scope of her political career, which is, by the way, much longer than Donald Trump's. This is someone who should be used to the questions, should be used to having to pick a side, should be used to having to be able to defend her policy position. So it's very strange to me that we're looking at this not just for a candidate running for the presidency, but the current vice president who is unable to put down her policy positions, not to mention she is currently serving with Joe Biden, who is somehow the president of the United States, right? So it should be very easy to figure out your policy positions, because I would assume you have some when you are currently in charge of the country. So it's very strange to see that go up 48 hours before the debate. It's very strange how those policy positions are presented. And I truly believe whether Americans are, you know, Republican or Democrat, left or right, they know what they deserve, and they're not satisfied with a couple of sentences on the different issues that truly do mean a lot to most.
Well, you know what seems odd is, you know, I looked over the things that she offered up, and she says, we're going to be really tough on the border. We're going to have a strong border enforcement. And I thought, you've been in charge of this for 3.5 years. I realize the mainstream media has tried to say, oh, no, she was never border czar. There was never a job like that, and she wasn't assigned to it. But we all know that we all listened when she was announced as the border czar, and we all watched as she did her best to stay as far away from the border as she possibly could. But is she really going to be able to run by running against her own positions? I mean, tomorrow night, is she going to be debating herself?
Yeah, I mean, she's not just debating herself. She's basically debating her own administration, right? I mean, you can only separate yourself from Joe Biden and this administration so much when you are coming from the White House to the debate, leaving the debate and going right back to the White House, right? You're the current vice president. I think that's the question Donald Trump has to ask. That's what we all have to ask. How do you feel, Kamala Harris, that Joe Biden has done as president? Because you have to figure out that the American people are going to assume that you were a part of this administration. That's not lost on anybody. And it's up to you to tell us, are you going to do something different? Are you going to do something new? Are you going to go further right? Are you going to go further left? And why are you going to do that? And the only way to get those answers is to have her pressed correctly by these moderators tomorrow at the debate. We knew before she became the nominee, right, before they kicked Joe Biden off that ticket, that the American people believed that Donald Trump was more trustworthy than Joe Biden on the majority of issues that mattered to them. That's immigration, that's the economy, that's safety and security. So for her, it's up to her to decide if she wants to separate herself from Joe Biden and where that leaves her on these issues, because the American people know they're not doing well right now. They know how poorly things have been run these last nearly 4 years, and they are not stupid. They are fully aware that she is the current vice president, so she certainly has a lot to answer for.
Well, and in fact, one of the things that bothered me today, Elizabeth, just a couple of hours ago, she had done a radio interview with, I think it was a Ricky Smiley show, and she said, it's time for us to turn the page away from this divisiveness. It was a very simple, short statement. But I thought, your administration, you're the one who worked with Joe Biden and to my knowledge, never pushed back. When I expected Joe Biden to bash Donald Trump. I mean, I'm a Trump advocate, but I expected him because that's what Joe would do. He's running against Trump, so he's going to bash Trump. But he was bashing not just Trump, But everybody believes in MAGA, which includes me, a lot of the people who listen to this show, not all of them, but a lot of them. And he's bashing Americans. And I thought, and now the vice president who stood by silently while her boss bashed, say, 40% of America, is now going to say, now it's time to turn the page and stop being divisive. Well, where were you 3 years ago?
Right. Honestly, it seems to me like the party that they have become, the Democrats at this point, is the party that believes they can get away with any kind of rhetoric, right, without having to back that up with any kind of actions. They believe the American people will see a headline and believe it without actually taking the time to do the research for themselves. I think it's incredibly disrespectful, and I think that's the reason that they're losing voters in so many groups that they previously relied on, right? The Jewish vote, the female vote, the Hispanic vote, the black vote. People are realizing that this party has taken them for granted. When it comes to calling for an end of divisiveness from two people that have called Donald Trump and his supporters some of the worst names that I could even imagine. I think she said this actually the other day, and then she visited a, please correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it was a spice shop in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, yep. Which is actually known for how divisive they are. I believe they renamed Martin Luther King Jr. Day to Republicans Are Racist Day. I mean, this is what people do, and this is what they get away with, because Kamala Harris and a lot of Democrats believe they can give a really snazzy headline that's going to get printed because they know their words won't get twisted in the mainstream media, but then they continue acting and speaking the way they have been for 8 years, knowing, by the way, how bad things are in the country, how divided we are, knowing that a man lost his life at a rally for Donald Trump, knowing Donald Trump nearly lost his life in front of millions of people, and knowing just how many Americans are suffering from this divide, right? It's not just the economy and immigration and so many issues. Americans are losing friends and family over politics, and they know that. But they know that that divide only fuels the flames of their party and of the far left, and they know that it helps them. So I don't see them trying to put a stop to that at any point, and I think it's incredibly hypocritical for anyone to blame Donald Trump for any kind of rhetoric when this is what we've seen and felt from the left for nearly 10 years now.
Okay, I'm talking to Elizabeth Pipko from the RNC. So in the last minute we've got, Joe Biden did one debate, fell flat on his face, and it was over. What happens tomorrow night or after tomorrow night if Kamala Harris does the same? Not in the same way, but the same, I mean, what happens when she flops?
Time to find a third candidate, right? I mean, we gotta keep looking.
Who's on the bench, Elizabeth? I mean, who's sitting there on the bench for the Democrats? Gretchen Whitmer, Gavin Newsom, what?
Probably one of those two. It's a strange bench. I don't see that happening. However, nothing would surprise us with American politics right now, let's be honest. We have, I think, 56 days to go to Election Day. I would assume it's a little late, but I would put nothing past the Democrats at this point. And I hope she flops the way I believe that she will, but I just hope the American people get the truth, right? That's what matters. And I don't know if any other, you know, candidate on their bench can save them at this point.
Yeah, I think they're in trouble. That's Elizabeth Pipko, RNC National Spokeswoman. Elizabeth, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. Your calls and emails coming up in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. The Biden Harris.
Ever wonder what a vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Our X-Poll question today: should state worker contract negotiations be known to workers but secret from the taxpayers? Washington State employees plan to walk off the job tomorrow at noon in the state of Washington to protest the governor's wage offer. Now, they say it's disrespectful. They say he's not paying a livable pay rate. And if you want to know, well, how much are they offering? And the answer is, we don't know. And when will the public know? After the ink is dry on the contract. That's when you'll know how much you and your representatives have agreed to pay these public servants. So I would answer no. You can answer any way you like. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to a naysayer. Dan, what do you and I disagree about today that makes you a naysayer?
Well, you think Trump's a smart person. That's not possibly believable. You don't believe that either.
I do. Can I tell you
why?
So
can I ask you a question first?
Well, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Do you need ID to buy groceries?
No.
No. Okay. So Trump says you do. He said it twice. It's
in what what context? I don't know what the context was. And usually those examples, you have to know in what context did he say, if I write a check to pay for groceries,
nope.
They routinely ask me for
that.
Well, okay, then do you know the context in which he said it?
Well, you think he's smart and you're one of his biggest fans, so why don't you know about this?
Why do I, am I not the all-knowing, all-seeing, omniscient Lars? Because
no.
I've never
Lars,
claimed to be. But if you want to hear why, can I tell you why?
Yeah. Why
I think, okay, you know what? We used to ban Dan from the show. He is re-banned at this point because he doesn't want to have a conversation. He just wants to talk over. I wanted to answer his question. Here's why I think Donald Trump is smart. Let's start with this one piece of evidence. Most people, if you inherited $20 million when you were 18 or 20 years of age, would probably in 20 years have half of that amount. Donald Trump inherited some money in the millions, maybe even the tens of millions. He is now worth billions of dollars. Now, if you say, well, that's easy to do. If you start with $10 million, it's easy to make a billion. I guarantee you there are plenty of people in this country who inherit $5 million, $10 million, $20 million, $50 million, and in a few years they have spent most of it or maybe even all of it, and they haven't made a dime. In Trump's case, Trump turned and he made money, and he made money by taking risks. And yes, some of his companies went bankrupt. Most of the famous names of billionaires you've ever heard of were people who went or their companies went bankrupt at one point. If you're out there in business and you're taking risks, and that's what business is about, taking risks that nobody else wants to take, then you're going to have companies that don't succeed. But if you have more success than you have failure, then you're an overall success. I'd say that makes Trump a very smart guy. Let's go to Mariah. Hey, Mariah, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Thank you, Lars. I'm calling today after catching the last bit of your last segment about Kamala Harris with the Republican National Convention leader. My question is there any way you could possibly take some calls and open up the lines to Kamala voters? Because I'm trying to understand what makes their brains work.
Do you know, Mariah, just to answer that question out of the gate, I'll answer that one out of the gate. If I started getting a stack of pro-Kamala callers right now, I would take every single one of them. And I would ask them, and I ask most people who call in and say, I like Kamala Harris, I hate Trump. I say, okay, tell me what you like about her as a president. Tell me what she can do or has done or will do that makes you impressed by her. And almost all of them have no answer whatsoever. All they know is she's not Donald Trump. And so
bad PR lies.
Yeah, that's it, is that you say, so you hate Trump, but what's good about her? Well, she's not Trump. And I go, that's her primary qualification? She's not Donald Trump?
I'm trying to find some understanding of what, you know, these polls show her in a slight lead or competing with Trump, but I don't understand when every single person I've talked to, even the most far-left people I know, and none of them support her. And I'm like, where is all this support coming from? Is it Miss Wall facade in a movie set? Because I'm just not buying it. I'm not ready to bypass on another election. I don't believe our president has actually won, because I still to this day don't believe Biden naturally won our election.
I don't either, Mariah. And let me tell you this. If one of the biggest issues, because the Democrats wanted to be, is abortion. So consider what Dobbs did. They saw that as a loss. In some ways, I don't like it, but I'm pro-life. But in some ways, they won. And why is that? Because they were told by the court, this is going to be the decision of your state. So what has happened in Oregon? Any abortion, any time, as late in pregnancy as you want. How about Washington? How about Washington State? Same deal. California, any abortion you want, any time. Now, it bothers them that the state of Idaho has said we don't want any abortions at all. And other states have said we want a 6-week limit or a 15-week limit. But the point is, about 20 or 22 of the states have said, we're going to have abortion anytime you want it, any way you want it, and we'll get the taxpayers to pay for it. You would think they'd be happy with that. No, they want to force their point of view on everybody else. And so they see abortion as an issue. Donald Trump says, do what the Supreme Court said. Give the decision to the people of the state.
The Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's a Tuesday, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program Senator Marsha Blackburn, who, if there is any justice, will be watching tomorrow night's debate and playing a drinking game that every time Kamala Harris mentions how well the American economy is going, Marsha Blackburn will take a fine sip of Tennessee whiskey, and by the end of the evening, she won't have to be all that bothered by what happens during the debate. Senator Blackburn, welcome back. That probably doesn't describe your regular drinking habits, but tomorrow night, I want to know what you think we're going to hear from her about, number one, people can't afford the basics, but number two, we've got a great economy. It's Bidenomics, and it's going great.
Well, Lars, we know she will have her talking points. We know she's going to be very rehearsed. She is going to be scripted. And like any well-trained actress or spokesperson, she's going to stand up there and do her lines. I think the interest will come when President Trump turns to her and asks her questions, things that she maybe is not expecting. Because you're right, she's going to try to convince everybody that what they're seeing at the grocery store is not real. And it's the problem of the grocery companies, not the problem of the economy. She's going to try to convince them that it is the oil and gas companies that are upping the price of a gallon of gas, and it has nothing to do with the fact that they killed the Keystone Pipeline and in the first 100 days took action after action to limit what you can do with oil and gas leases, what you can do with drilling, what you can do with refining. This is all part of their playbook. They have made life more expensive, and quite frankly, I think tomorrow night the American people will see that Kamala Harris is too expensive to afford.
Let me ask you this. Kamala Harris and her campaign put out what was supposed to be a bunch of policy statements the first time they put it on the website at all. I mean, Obama had one early on. Hillary had one early on. Donald Trump had all of his policy statements up in September of 2015, more than a year before the election. And Harris finally gets around to it now. And to me, it looked like a bunch of bumper sticker slogans. We're going to make America, well, she couldn't say we're going to make America great again, but we're going to bring down costs. And it's those greedy corporations that have just unilaterally decided to charge everybody more at the same time that all of their costs have gone up. And, you know, labor's gone up, energy's gone up, everything's gone up. And it's just greedy corporations. And if the government tells the corporations how much they're allowed to charge, that's going to work. Do you think this woman knows any history going back to, say, Nixon and wage and price controls? And I was a Republican, and they don't work. And nor do I think the corporation should put up with her putting the blame on them.
Well, you're right about that. And as far as having a background in economics, no, I don't think that she does. And I think she's just removed, as so many elitists in D.C. are, from the impact of inflation on their lives. When you look at the fact that when Donald Trump was president, I could buy a dozen eggs for $1.79.
Yep.
And now they're north of $3. I could buy a gallon of milk for $2, and now it's $3.99. When you look at where a gallon of gas was and what it cost you today to go put that gallon of gas in your tank, if you can see $3 a gallon gas, you would be celebrating. But you don't get that anymore. Those costs have gone up. When you talk to people about their insurance cost, when you talk to them about what is happening with the cost of clothing, and then you look at all the cost around putting a child in school with clothes, with school supplies. When you talk to people that work in small business manufacturing and you hear about their supply chain issues and how sometimes they have to shut the line down and people lose pay for 2 or 3 days because they're waiting for parts. This is the impact of this administration, where inflation overall is north of 20%.
Yep.
From the day Joe Biden and Kamala Harris walked into the West Wing of the White House, and people are living it. They feel it every day.
So why do you suppose there are still, at least according to the polls, so many people who support her? Because I can't wrap my head around it, saying, you know, the same way Reagan did in the early 80s when he was running, said, look, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And if the answer is no, you know, if you think you're better off, vote for Kamala Harris. But I can't imagine who it is out there that's better off today than they were 4 years ago.
And it is hard to imagine there is anyone better off today, because they are all dealing with the impact of inflation. Look at heating and cooling costs. We're just coming off of a very hot August in Tennessee, and just about everywhere I went, they were complaining about what their electric bill was because of that really hot August. And people are dealing with these costs. And, you know, your utility costs are up well over 33%.
Yep.
Rent is up. People that are getting kids back to college, and you're hearing these stories about these elevated rent rates that kids are having to pay. And that's not what the rent rate was when last year they were applying at colleges and were going through acceptances, and then they were finding themselves signing contracts at a much higher rate than what they were quoted when they went by 6 months ago.
Senator Blackburn, I've got about a minute left. Tell me this. You sent a letter off to, or it's been sent out by you to the Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Meta or Facebook, saying that Facebook or Meta has been shadow banning or censoring people because they were Olympians who competed in shooting sports?
Yes. And we found out this was happening. We have sent a letter over to Meta. It is important for us to make them aware that every time they do something like this, we're watching and we are keeping track of what they are doing. If they don't approve of what you see and what you are saying, then they are going to ban you. They're going to slow your speeds. We know that they are doing this, and this censorship has to stop, so we continue to chronicle it. And a way to hold them accountable is to send a letter every time they start this process of shadow banning and slowing the speeds for these different entities.
Thank you very much. That's Senator Marsha Blackburn from the great state of Tennessee. Back in a moment. I'll get to your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. And did Joe Biden ignore all the warnings about pulling out of Afghanistan?
At least someone has
a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
The extraordinary success of this mission was due to the incredible skill, bravery, and selfless courage of the United States military and our diplomats and intelligence professionals. For weeks, they risked their lives to get American citizens, Afghans who helped us, citizens of our allies and partners and others on board planes and out of the country.
That is Joe Biden, and that was 3 years ago in September of 2021. And this is the Lars Larson Show. That's a very consequential date, not just because of the terrorist attacks more than 20 years ago, but because Joe Biden decided that come hell or high water, he was going to make sure that America got out of Afghanistan by September the 11th, 2021. Nothing more important than just that date. And what was the result of that? 13 dead service members. Thousands, literally thousands of Americans who are left behind, both green card holders and citizens, and then a lot of people who are not American citizens, but people who had aided us in Afghanistan during the 17 years that America was there. Well, a brand new report has come out from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. The Republican majority released a report. It is more than 350 pages, and it says this: President Biden's insistence on withdrawing from Afghanistan, no matter the cost, despite repeated warnings from the military and our allies in NATO, that decision exposed American personnel to security threats and allowed the Taliban to very quickly take the country over and turn it into a terrorist safe haven. And not only that, but to leave behind literally tens of billions of dollars. I'm not going to debate the exact amount, but it was tens of billions of dollars of equipment that we left behind in Afghanistan. And yet, it doesn't seem that this has made an impact on the American public to a large extent. The fact is that we have a president in office right now. Thank God he'll leave in January, but he foisted Kamala Harris on us, and she's now running to continue his policies. He made the decision to end up leaving Afghanistan in such a way that it got 13 service members killed. It was a disaster, both a humanitarian disaster, a financial disaster, a military equipment disaster, and it left the Taliban in charge of the country. And all you got from Joe Biden was excuses, like the excuses about the military deaths. Take a listen to that.
20 service members were wounded in the service of this mission. 13 heroes gave their lives. I was just at Dover Air Force Base for the dignified transfer. We owe them and their families a debt of gratitude we can never repay, but we should never, ever, ever forget.
Now, that's what Joe Biden said 3 years ago, in September 3 years ago. But when he said, I was just at Dover Military Base, Air Base, to watch as the remains of those 13 service members were brought back. This is the ceremony in which Joe Biden, President of the United States, literally looked down at his watch to decide how much more time, how long is this going to go on? If that's the kind of respect that Joe Biden wants to give to our military, then so be it, because I don't think he has much regard for our military. But he was absolutely dead set that he wanted to end that war, even though he's now tried to blame the decision on his predecessor. Listen to this.
In April, I made a decision to end this war. As part of that decision, we set the date of August 31st for American troops to withdraw. The assumption was that more than 300,000 Afghan National Security Forces that we had trained over the past two decades and equipped would be a strong adversary in their civil wars with the Taliban. That assumption that the Afghan government would be able to hold on for a period of time beyond military drawdown turned out not to be accurate.
Assumption. Well, we all know what happens when you assume. But in this case, Joe Biden was warned, according to this brand new report from the House Foreign Affairs Committee, that he was warned by our military, by our NATO allies, that American security personnel were going to be exposed to threats, the Taliban would quickly take over the country, and they did. He was warned by our own military. He decided, as he said, his decision to do this was based on an artificial timeline. They also point out that the Taliban was not holding up its end of the agreement. Do you remember what Donald Trump has said over and over again? When he met with the Taliban, when he talked to the Taliban, he said, listen, if you don't hold up your end of the agreement, I know where you live, and we're going to come and get you. Joe Biden didn't do that. All he wanted to do was bend over backwards. And what did the Taliban end up with? They ended up with an entire country. They ended up with a place for terrorists to take a safe haven. They ended up with massive amounts of American high-tech gear, including helicopters, Humvees, armored personnel carriers, small arms, night vision goggles, the whole nine yards, and God knows where that stuff is today. But Joe Biden made all of that happen. It killed people. It put Americans at risk. It left thousands of Americans behind the lines. And I'll remind you that in August, 3 years ago, Joe Biden stood right there in front of the cameras and he said, listen, I am not going to have our military leave Afghanistan until every single American is out. And for weeks, they managed to maintain the premise that, well, no, all the Americans got out. Maybe a few were left behind. It turned out to have been thousands of people who are left behind, and Joe Biden is on the hook for that as well. And I certainly hope that Donald Trump brings it up on debate night. Let's go first to Ted. Hey, Ted, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call, Lars. I want to bring up a reoccurring issue that's been going on for the last 30 years. Illegal marijuana grows in national forests. If people don't believe me, they can look up a California Fish and Wildlife officer, a National Forest officer, I forget what he was, but his name is John Norris, N like Nicholas, O-R-E-S. He busted and has been busting illegal Mexican cartel and Chinese mafia grows in the Northern California Siskiyou National Forest, where all these illegal aliens and cartels are dumping banned chemicals that we're not even allowed to use in the U.S., dumping them into watersheds, dumping them into streams, ruining the environment. They have to call out environmental remediation teams. And I want to say the Democrats are hypocrites, such hypocrites for not taking care of this issue while harping on everyone else over minor things like the vehicles that we drive.
And by the way, Ted, to add to that, not only are the cartels running all those plantations on public lands that are owned by the rest of us, not only are they doing all the environmental damage, stealing water, you know, cutting down trees, all of that, but they're doing one other thing. They're engaging in slavery. I mean, I know myself because I've talked to sheriffs who've gone in and raided some of these illegal cartel-run plantations. How do you suppose they get all the handwork, the labor done? They get it done with slaves. And I'll describe them as slaves because they are brought from Mexico, human trafficked into America, taken to these plantations, held with inadequate food, inadequate shelter. They're not getting paid. They're simply being told, you're going to work off your debt to the cartel. In other words, the policies of Joe Biden have made it possible to bring slavery back to the United States to aid and abet the cartels, both Chinese and Mexican, in growing marijuana or whatever else they're growing on public lands. It's doing environmental damage, it is illegal, and it involves human slavery, and you got to put that at Joe Biden's feet as well. Ted, thanks so much for the call. 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. A message from Lars.
I'd like to apologize to anyone I've not offended yet. Please be patient. I'll get to you shortly.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And we've talked before on this program about diversity, equity, and inclusion. I don't think much of the idea. And in fact, I think we're seeing some of the fruits of that come home in a disabled spacecraft that just returned to Earth over the weekend from the space station. But they didn't trust to put astronauts on board. Airplanes with parts that fly loose in flight and a lot of other disastrous things that probably aren't significant enough to be noticed as products of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But if you're getting ready to send your kids off to college or they've already gone, you should be aware that your kids may, in fact, run right into this buzzsaw of DEI. And I thought we'd talk about that with Sherrese Trump. No relation. She is the executive director of Speech First, a nonprofit organization specializing in defending free speech on college campuses. Sherrese, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So what is happening on the University of South Carolina campus that may well be replicated on other American college campuses to one degree or another that should concern parents and the students, too?
Yeah, well, I guarantee this is happening on other campuses just based on what we've seen. So this is a training module that all students must complete before they can register for classes. They will not have access to course registration unless they pass the module that includes a multiple choice quiz at the end. They have to score an 80% or higher on. And basically, it's a DEI module. So it's literally called, they have a couple of different ones on alcoholism and some other things, but then one separately is on DEI specifically. And when you look at the questions, it's like the clearest example I've seen of clear coercion attempts at indoctrination and brainwashing. Like, they are literally forcing students to click on the correct answer. If you click on the wrong one, it will say this is the incorrect answer, and then it will show you what the correct answer actually is. And just to give you some examples of what this module includes, when one of the questions says to talk about what are the positive, or what is diversity, inclusion, and belonging? And if you click on, for example, you'll see in the article, too, that we have out, that it's actually gives certain people unfair advantages based on their marginalized identity groups. It will tell you that that is an incorrect answer, and that it is it instead, the correct answer is that it exposes students to people from different backgrounds and enriching the overall campus experience. Another one on here says basically.
No, hold on a second, Sherrese. Mm-hmm. So am I right if I interpret that to say you may have said this gives people an unfair advantage? That is wrong think, you know, to use 1984.
Yeah, 100%.
That's wrong think. Yeah. We are going to tell you the right way to think about it. And all it is oh, I get to be exposed to all these interesting people with different backgrounds than mine. It has nothing to do with giving anybody an advantage that isn't enjoyed by everybody else, even though we know that's categorically not true.
Exactly. And they don't make it so that it's, oh, there's, you know, there are multiple answers and, you know, some answers are more right than others. No, they are saying this is the incorrect answer and this is the correct answer. And it will be docked against your final score in order for you to have access to class registration if you do not click the correct answer. And they're very explicit about that in the module. And so this is clear, you know, evidence of coercion. And again, not surprised, though, because Speech First, we launched a FOIA campaign a couple years ago where we got a bunch of information from universities across the campus or across the country, you know, on their freshman orientation materials, because we were wondering the same thing. We're wondering, why are students so sensitive to each other? Why can't they have conversations without freaking out? Why are they reporting on each other with these anonymous reporting systems? And we realized because 91% of the materials that we FOIA'd from the orientation programs were DEI themed, which means students were coming in on campus and being told from the get-go that they should be looking over their shoulders, they're going to be offended, that they should be watching out for microaggressions and using trigger warnings, and, you know, that everyone who's white has some version of privilege and implicit bias. And this is what they go around thinking because this is what they're being told constantly, all the way K through 12, all the way through freshman orientations, and through campus learning as well, in the dorms, during graduations, they're all segregated. Again, this is something that students are just so inundated with that they can't help but start to follow suit. And that's what indoctrination looks like. That's what brainwashing actually looks like. So this module is just one kernel of everything that's been happening to these students.
I'm talking to Sherrese Trump from Speech First. So let me ask you about two things. I mean, Sherlock Holmes always warned, watch for the dog that didn't bark. In this case, the word equity is dropped. It's diversity, inclusion, and belonging. Before I ask you about belonging, what's the explanation for why they dropped equity? Because I have a feeling it's still in there somewhere, but why do you suppose they decided to drop the E in DEI?
Well, this is the interesting thing about University of South Carolina is that they actually were under a lot of pressure from state lawmakers because they have a lot of conservative state lawmakers who are against this type of teaching and indoctrination. They were under a lot of pressure last year. So they renamed their DEI office and took out equity, and they also avoid using the words most of the time in diversity and inclusion, and rename things in order to kind of get themselves out of the spotlight. Belonging is the new one. That's the new trend. So
yeah, what is that?
A lot of the DEI offices, yeah. It's just a new way. Again, let's be clear what DEI actually is. When we're talking about DEI, it is critical theory in practice. So you're talking about Marxist, critical race theory, critical gender theory. It is what it looks like in practice through an administrative state, and that is what DEI is. So their goal with this is to infiltrate all these programs and all these institutions, and they have to do it undercover. They can't just blatantly, clearly and plainly state, we're trying to change your reality. We're trying to alter your or augment your reality by inputting our own reality, our own crazy ideology. So we're going to cover it up with a bunch of really fancy, nice-sounding words like diversity and inclusion and belonging. They got rid of equity because we were winning on that front. Equity is a term that those who are against DEI have been able to make a lot of progress on because it's clearly stated. And it's the least subtle of all the terms, I guess.
Well, I mean, just for Charisse, I realize you and I talk about this all the time. But for the people listening, equity means, okay, so all the kids are going to get, basically evaluated. Everybody's going to get an A, B, a C, a D, whatever. Oh, but this kid got a D, except he comes from a marginalized group, person of color,
right.
Gender, sexuality, whatever. And it's not right. It is an equitable that he should get a D. So we're going to artificially award him or her or them or there these days.
Yes,
we're going to award them a B. And you say, well, how do they get a B? Their scores gave them a D. And you say, well, because of equity. And I have a feeling that's still going on. Am I right?
Oh, it's certainly going on. We've just had more, we've been more successful on that front, because America was designed to be a meritocracy. So it's starting to backfire a little bit on the DEI, kind of ideological, army that's kind of just taking over all of the institutions. And one thing I'll mention on that front is it's just important because a lot of people do try to use equity and equality as synonyms, and especially if they're trying to just throw it in there really quickly without anyone noticing, they are not synonymous. They are very different definitions, as you were describing. Equality is equal opportunity. Equity is equal outcomes. So
yep.
That is exactly what communism practices. And it is about forcing outcomes so that everyone's equal, which means they are lowering. They are the people who are highly successful, highly individualistic. They are lowering them. They are hurting their records, their successes, in order to bring them down to a different level while they're also raising others up who are not as successful and not as advantageous. So that is something that, again, it's a manufactured or manipulation of the outcomes by the state, by the administrators, to intentionally force equal outcomes. And it goes directly against meritocracy, like I said, which is, the American way. We pull ourselves up from our bootstraps and we work hard, and we expect that with hard work and perseverance that we are going to see some sort of payout, that we're going to be successful. And that is kind of what the American capitalist spirit is all about.
Exactly right. And if your kids are going off to college, Charisse, thank you very much. If your kids are going off to college, ask them if they're getting this DEI stuff rammed down their throats. You've got the Lars Larson Show. With me on the...
And now, this musical message to anyone who wants to indoctrinate our school children.
Hey, teacher, leave the kids alone.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. I want to get to your phone calls and emails. I do want to mention this. James Earl Jones. Yeah, the guy whose voice was the voice of Mufasa in The Lion King, his voice of, Vader. He was the voice of CNN. I'm not sure that's a positive, but he has passed away at the age of 93. A great talent in voice, and James Earl Jones has passed away at the age of 93. We got that word a short time ago. Glad to have you with me. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists, Oregon Medical Centers. Linda, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well,
Hey, Lars, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
My husband called me on the called me and told me about what's going on in Ohio.
Springfield, Ohio. Yep. Tell the audience it is so outrageous and crazy, you almost can't believe it.
I am a total animal lover, and these Haitians are torturing our animals and eating them and smashing cats and in front of what can we do about this, Lars?
Well, let's start with this. The report is out of Springfield, Ohio. A man who lives there said that Haitian illegals who are in the country have been catching the ducks in public parks, decapitating them, and then eating them. And he showed up at a city council meeting, and he said, look, you've got all these Haitian so-called immigrants, migrants, whatever you want to call them, and they're not here legally. And, you know, Joe Biden may have said, you've got indefinite humanitarian parole, but all this is just to get people passed. But he says these Haitians are running into trash cans. They're running into buildings. They're flipping cars in the middle of the streets. They're in the park. They're grabbing up ducks by the neck and cutting their heads off and walking off with them. And they are eating them. Now, Linda, I want to warn you, the legacy media is going to want to shut that story down as fast as they possibly can. It's being reported by the Daily Mail and other, I think, responsible journalists reporting on what this man had to say. They're going to say, there's no evidence that's happening. And here's what they'll base it on, Linda. They're going to say, and they have been saying, that Springfield police in Springfield, Ohio, have said, we have had no formal reports that that is happening. Now, let me ask you, you live in Grants Pass here in the Northwest. If something happens and you know it happened, but it never gets reported to the police, did it still happen?
Yes.
Yeah. And do all significant things or even insignificant things get reported to the police? No. But what the media will say is, well, there's no evidence. Evidence meaning if a tree fell in the forest and nobody called the cops and told them it fell, then the tree didn't fall. That's what they're going to try to argue. But there are crazy. And the thing is, when I saw the story first, I thought I could see that happening. I mean, people are being allowed into this country illegally. Some of them are being given tremendous amounts of resources, thousands of dollars, debit cards, plane tickets, bus tickets, hotel rooms, and everything else. But there are a lot of others who are hungry. They don't have any food. And the Biden administration let this happen, knowing that if you let millions of people into the country and they don't have the food to eat, some of them are going to steal it. Some of them are going to go to a public park and kill it. So do I find it outrageous to believe that this is happening? I think it's outrageous it is happening, but I don't find it unbelievable, even if it hasn't been reported to the police. And it's also hard for me to imagine somebody saying, that illegal just grabbed two ducks, cut their heads off, and it looks like he's going to take them off and barbecue them. Would you necessarily call the police, knowing that the police already have their hands full with everything else and aren't probably going to do anything about it anyway? So why would you call the police and report it? I think it happened, and the mainstream media is going to say this makes Kamala Harris, former border czar, look very bad, and we can't have that.
Oh yeah, but there's got to be something that we can do, like flyers and protesting.
You know what you have to do? You have a very clear choice. Who created this problem? The Biden-Harris regime. Who would continue to allow millions of people to flood into this country? Well, Kamala Harris today says she wants a strong border. But what she did for 3.5 years as border czar was absolutely zip. Nor did she stand up as vice president and say, I can't believe Joe Biden's letting millions of people into this country. It's going to do tremendous damage. We've got terrorists coming in. We've got convicted criminals coming in. She didn't say a word. So do you think it's reasonable for me to assume this is a woman who 5 years ago said we should decriminalize entry to the United States? If she becomes president, do you have any doubt she will continue these policies?
No doubt. And I think I know what I need to do.
That's exactly what you need to do. Vote for different leadership. Willow, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
It's about equity in the grade system in schools.
Yeah.
If the kids are getting lower grades, instead of altering moronically the grade equity business, why not give those kids more individualized instruction and in a kind and gentle and productive way teach them the things that will make their lives better?
I think the short answer is that's too hard. I think that's what they're going to say. That's too hard. The Democrats have a very low set of expectations for people of color and people from other groups like that. I have a high set of expectations. Do the work, you can get the A. Don't do the work, you're going to have to take the D. I think that's perfectly fair.